It begins with this great word glory that we thought about last week, a word that could be defined in many ways, but really is a word that sums up a sense of God's essential character. Jesus is saying, let the reality of who you are, God, be shown in me, and may I show it. There's that sense that that's really the thing that matters the most, and that essence, as described here in this prayer, is a communal reality. What is the essence of God? The essence of God is perfect communion, Father, Son, and Spirit. This extraordinary sense of a communion in which there's never separation, there's no cynicism, there's no prejudice, there's no sense of distance, there's full knowledge and full intimacy. A portrait of communion, which is the perfect communion out of which all other communion actually comes into existence. It's an amazing portrait. As he goes on to talk about this prayer and to long that he should reflect that prayer, so then he extends, of course, that community to us, to the people that are the people of God. And he says, I want all of those that you have given me. I want you to know that all those that you've given me, I have given back to you. They belong to you as they belong now to me. You gave them to me. I took care of them. Not one of them is lost, and now I give them back to you. There's this, again, in this section of the text, this theme of belonging, this sense that our home, our life, our sense of restedness, of the place where we are most fully meant to be ourselves, is in this community. It's one of the reasons why, as I've been going through these weeks of reflection in anticipation of this series, and as I've been walking through these early days of Lent, I've tried in a way to just try to inhabit this prayer. I want to encourage you to do that. I want to encourage you to think about memorizing it. I want to encourage you to think about, in some genuine sense, putting it on, letting this be the definition of the place in which you live each day, the context out of which all the other work and relationships and crises and dramas of our own individual lives and of our collective life as a congregation and of our life as human beings is really enfolded in this kind of love. So this morning we're going to think about this theme of belonging and what Jesus here is talking about. Notice again the language. I am asking on behalf, on their behalf. I am not asking on behalf of the world, but on behalf of those whom you gave me, because they are yours. All mine are yours, and yours are mine. And I have been glorified, that is, I have revealed myself, and they have accepted that in themselves. Our instinct of belonging, of course, is a primary definitional instinct of our existence as human beings. We, by essence of being born, need to belong. Our existence actually depends on our belonging in some way or another to a family. Our earliest development has to do with attachment and a sense of place that where we feel as though we are truly connected. Part of the extraordinary emergence of those tiny little lives like Michael's life that we baptized this morning, this tiny, vulnerable, fragile little baby who needs every day to grow in his sense that he is truly one who belongs in his family, that he is really at home with those who God has given to care for him in these earliest days. And as we grow, we, of course, continue to need that belonging. And part of the fearsomeness, the overwhelmingness at times of emerging out into the outer world is that sense of stepping out beyond that immediate nest into some wider circle. It happens through friends. It happens through extended family. It happens ultimately through those moments which we get to witness day in and day out during the week through our own Cornerstone Children's Program. When little tiny babies arrive in that program, but also as they begin to socialize with one another in that parallel play that littlest children do, and then gradually they begin to sort of start playing together. There are those wonderful moments where every day children go out for a walk, and the littlest children, as they go out for a walk, of course, in that way that happens in lots of little preschools, is that they all hold onto a little rope, you know, and they kind of walk along together and tell you we're going for a walk. And there's this amazing sense that they're declaring to you that they know that they're there, that they know they're together, that they know they're doing the right thing, and they're telling you, I'm going for a walk today. And there's something really just so wonderful about that moment. I love talking to them when they're out for their little walks because it just has this great sense that all is really right in the world. It kind of all seems aligned. They just know what they're doing, and they're walking forward, and this great moment is happening. But of course, in those moments, as little children, despite what it may appear, and certainly as we keep growing, our sense of belongingness, of course, becomes jeopardized and compromised and questioned for all kinds of reasons. because not everyone around us wants to belong to us, or vice versa. And there are lots of signals that come from us to us from tiniest ages and as we grow, where we're not really sure that we do belong or that we even want to belong. Part of the drama that continues through grade school and that sense of what it means to find yourself in a classroom and to be in a setting where you're not sure really what's going on and you're trying to figure out what it means to belong finally reaches the apex of that drama when we come to those wonderful years known as middle school, where so much of middle school has to do with what today or tomorrow or last week or day after tomorrow is going to be the definition of my belonging. A lot of the social dynamics of what middle school is trying to sort out is a sense of where is my place? Do I belong or don't I belong? Yesterday at 4 I belonged, but this morning at 9 I don't. That's part of the crisis of being in middle school, that feeling of either I've told them they don't belong or I've been told I don't belong or I'm not sure who I want to have belong to me or who I want to belong to. There's kind of this shuffling of cards that's very complicated and very vulnerable. And at times it's full of bravado and at times it's full of an inner sense of questioning and lostness. A lot of what we're trying to figure out is how will we know where we belong? What will be the cues? And to what do we want to belong? Insofar as we can choose it, where are we going to make those choices? Insofar as other people are choosing on our behalf, what are the choices that are being made for us? It can be a very complicated time. I remember this significant moment when I was a vulnerable seventh grader. I had been this tall since I was 12. I mean, I just grew like a million inches in 1 year. Suddenly, I'm, you know, miles higher than the children that seem to be around me. And it was natural that as the year went on, I tried to find places that I could connect. And I had done various sports. Basketball was an obvious thing. And eventually in the spring, for the first time, I tried track. And because I was so tall, it was understandable that the coach said, well, then obviously you should be a hurdler. So I started doing hurdles, which can be really painful and really awkward and really sort of one of those things that in a way it was like a blessing and a curse early on. Then there came this moment, sort of midway in that seventh grade year in track, when this guy who was a ninth grader named Fernando Figueroa. I mean, is that like a great name or not? I mean, and Fernando to our middle school was like the definition of cool. He was like the coolest guy, and he was definitely the coolest guy on track. And he was a hurdler. And I remember the day when Fernando, who was our lead hurdler, gave me the nod. That was just amazing. It was like, wow, Fernando said, yes, you're going to be the guy. Like, I'm going to make sure you learn how to do this and that you succeed at this. That was a sense of belonging to a team. It was belonging to an identity. It was an important part of that sense of emergence physically and athletically that was part of that season of my life. But we all have those moments where sometimes we're told we belong, and I definitely had my share of moments where it was clear that I didn't get the nod. Where the person that I would have wished would have given me the nod really wasn't interested in giving me the nod. And the cue that I would have wished for didn't come. And my uncertainty about where I belonged and where I didn't belong was really undone. This continues in our lives for all kinds of different ways. It happens through high school in different ways. It happens in college in many new ways when we step often away from our families and into an entirely new environment where a sense of belonging now really has almost nothing to do, apparently, with our families, because now we arrive not surrounded by them or with them particularly close by, even if our parents do, as they say now, helicopter in. Really, on the whole, we're alone. And our sense of belonging and identity is a new thing. And there can be in that both great joy and great anxiety. I remember it was not long after I graduated from college that I had the opportunity to live for the first time in England. And England and living cross-culturally, as modest as that difference is between England and America, as has often been said, it's a people divided by a common language. And often that's the way the experience can go. And I remember the very first day that I arrived in England, this friend picked me up and took me to this place where I was going to spend a few days with a group of other people that were about my age. And as this happened, we drove up to the place where we were going to stay, and I opened the door, and as I've probably told you before, I said to the guy who was opening the door for me, hi. And he, in his Oxford-like way, said, we don't say hi here. We say hello. And I said, ew. It just was the beginning of that sense of, you don't belong here. You don't get it. You don't talk in the way that we're supposed to. Another friend, not long after that, was trying to teach me to drive a stick shift in London, the first place I'd ever tried to drive a stick shift car. and I'm on the wrong side of the road, and the stick shift is on the wrong side of the car, and he's giving me directions that I'm not understanding that say things like, go over the lights, and I can't figure out what that means, whether that means I'm supposed to drive over something or under something, or I couldn't figure out what it was, and it was all a cue that you don't belong here. This is not your home. You're not at home here. And many other signals. Now again, every culture has its ways of including and excluding. Every culture has its ways of telling people you belong or ways that you don't belong. It's been said by some Africans, we are, therefore I am. That's not my cultural definition. My culture says, if you think I think, therefore I am. It's a much more Cartesian, much more isolated self, much more of a feeling of being separated from others, not finding myself in others. Been said by one sociologist that many Asian cultures would say, I belong, therefore I am. There are different cultural cues that tell us whether we are part of whatever it is that we think we need or want or should be a part of, or whether we don't. It is a profound thing because sometimes it happens on the surface, but actually at the very core of our being, there is probably no issue that we hold more in common or that is more defining or more influential for how we're going to live in the world, whether we live in anxiety or fear, or whether we live in freedom, than whether or not the question of our belonging has actually been settled. We can spend unbelievable amounts of energy trying to make ourselves belong. We can spend unbelievable energy trying to create a self that has a home, and still not find ourselves at home. I'm sure that some of you have become fans of the writing of Khaled Hosseini, who wrote Kite Runner, but also wrote A Thousand Splendid Suns. He's an acute observer of human experience, and the opening of this novel, which again is set in Afghanistan, begins this way. Miriam was 5 years old the first time she heard the word harami. It happened on a Thursday. It must have, because Miriam remembered that she had been restless and preoccupied that day, the way she always was on Thursdays, the day when her father visited her. To pass the time until the moment that she would finally see him, crossing the knee-high grass in the clearing and waving to her, Miriam had climbed a chair and taken down her mother's Chinese tea set. The tea set was the sole relic that Miriam's mother, Nana, had of her own mother, who had died when Nana, Miriam's mother, was just 2. Nana cherished each blue and white porcelain piece, the graceful curve of the pot's spout, the hand-painted finches and chrysanthemums, the dragon on the sugar bowl, all meant to ward off evil. It was the last piece that slipped from Miriam's fingers, that fell to the wooden floorboards and shattered. When Nana saw the bowl, her face flushed red and her upper lip shivered and her eyes, both the lazy one and the good, settled on Miriam in a flat, unblinking way. Nana looked so mad that Miriam feared that jinn would enter her mother's body again. But it didn't, not that time. Instead, Nana grabbed Miriam by the wrists, pulled her close, and through gritted teeth said, "You are a clumsy little harami. This is my reward for everything I've endured, an heirloom-breaking, clumsy little harami." At the time, Miriam did not understand. She did not know what this word harami, bastard, meant, nor was she old enough to appreciate the injustice, to see that it is the creators of the harami who are culpable, not the harami, whose only sin is being born. Miriam did surmise, by the way Nana said the word, that it was an ugly, loathsome thing to be a harami, like an insect, like the scurrying cockroaches that Nana was cursing and sweeping out of their home. Later, when Miriam was older, she did understand. It was the way that Nana uttered the word, not so much saying it as spitting it at her, that made Miriam feel the sting of it. She understood then what Nana meant, that a harame was an unwanted thing, that she, Miriam, was an illegitimate person, who would never have legitimate claim to the things other people had, things such as love, family, home, acceptance. The whole rest of this story is about that crisis. And our lives can also be all about that crisis. A small or profound wound that leaves us with a sense that we have been found unacceptable, unwanted, not belonging. The text that we are looking at this morning is a text in which Jesus says, in prayer to God who knows and loves us all, those that you gave me, I have received. They belong to me, and I return them to you. I've given them gifts, he says. First, the gift of your name. That is, I've revealed the really essence of your character. I've told them about a name that is with them and for them. When God reveals his name, Yahweh, to Israel, a word which is a slightly mysterious word, but a word which conveys in essence, I am the one who is there, who is, and who is there for you. I'm there as the covenant-making, promise-making, promise-keeping God. That's who I am. That is my name, and you are to be known by my name. And now this name that had sadly in Israel's history become a name that was really a name of exclusion. It was a name which was largely a name for only those in the tribe of Israel. Now in the ministry and life of Jesus becomes a name that is shared broadly. So to the sinner, to the lost, to the Gentile, to the marginalized, to the injured, to the forgotten, to the misnamed, Jesus says, child, daughter, son, brother, sister. He says that because he extends the name of God that is the source of our life to all who will hear and trust. And our life now is about being known by that name, by being a name which is not about our name. I don't belong because I make a name for myself. I don't belong because I'm just the inheritor of a name that has been given to me, or a name that is earned by my job, or a name that is given to me because someone else decides to attach it to my life. I don't live the name that is attached as a curse, and I don't live the name that is attached as an honor. I live by the name that is given as a free and loving sacrificial gift that says, you are mine. You belong to me, and I belong to you, and you belong to one another. And then Jesus says, not only did I give them your name, but I taught them and gave them your word. And what is that word? It is certainly a word that involves instruction, but it's a word that in the ministry of Jesus means I gave them my life, which is the living word. And it also means I gave them a sense of their belonging to the story that is our word, that is the word that made the world. It's the word that sustains the world. It's the word that calls forth a people who will put their trust in the God who offers us life. It's to actually have a place of belonging in this great story that is God's story. And if you hear that word, and as Jesus says, receive it and trust it and live it, then you will know that sense of belonging that comes from the name of Jesus and from your place in the story of Jesus. It's an amazing image. And Jesus says, therefore, you are now the people of a new name. And you are now the people who not only are not called harame, cursed, unacceptable, marginalized, and disregarded. You are chosen. You are set apart. You are treasured and beloved. That's what Jesus is saying. He prays for those who belong to him and who, because they belong to him, now belong to one another. And our life together is really meant to be a life that enacts this belonging. It enacts a belonging that doesn't come about because we just look at each other in the same way. We now look at each other as those who, not because of our love, but because of the love of Jesus Christ, actually belong to God and to each other. And we seek to nurture a kind of community that now cuts across all these different lines of division. The community that is God's communion is a communion that is built not because we share the same politics, not because we share the same racial background, not because the names that have been bestowed on us by our earnings or by our privilege or by our absence of privilege has somehow been the name that now we just kind of mix together in the soup that's called the church. No, it's actually something much more profound than that. What God is wanting to do is quite deliberately say, I call to people under my name and in my story, people who would never think they belong here, people whose other stories have said they are Harames, either to themselves or because that name has been given to them, or either at a deep level or at a superficial level, wherever you may come from, the arms, the name, the word of Jesus Christ goes forth as a word of grace that knits us together in a new communion of belonging that doesn't happen because we've joined the club, that doesn't happen because we're able to pay a large entry fee, that doesn't happen because we deserved it by our background, because we earned our way in some particular way. No, it's just a gift. And not only is it not earned by those things, it's not made impossible because of all the things we've failed to do. We're not kept on the edge because, yeah, but really if they knew the story, we'd never be invited in. And Jesus, who knows the whole story, says, and it's exactly you, who think you're at the margins, who are lost, it's you I invite in. Really, it's like this sort of an image. Jesus is saying, there is a home in which you have been made to live. It is the home that is the communion of God, Father, Son, and Spirit, together with God's unlikely people. Most people live homelessly in the world, desperate for a sense of belonging, but wandering around trying to find someplace they can belong, trying to find the Fernando Figueroas or whoever it may be that's going to say to you, you belong. And we'd wait for those cues, and we anxiously hope for those cues, and we try to do everything we can to set ourselves up for those cues, and we try to manage them, and we try to buy them, and we try to earn them. We try to overcome the wrong ones. We try to get the right ones. And it's all about still feeling fundamentally homeless. And Jesus says, but the gift I want you to give and receive, the gift that I want you to know is yours, is a gift that you belong to me, that you are home in me, and you are home with each other. Now that's a challenge, of course. It's a challenge in the first instance because we have to accept God's grace. But it's also a challenge because we have to not only accept God's grace for ourselves, we have to accept God's grace for each other. This is what the church is not all that good at doing often. So we're invited into the same community, but we don't actually extend to one another what God, we know, wants to extend to each of us. So we don't live like a belonging community. We still live often in pockets. The church across the world lives in its isolated pockets, not in its unexplained communion. We have the chance, as every church does in its own local setting, to practice this communion, to pray by God's grace that we will see one another in the way that Jesus Christ sees us, to see one another through the eyes of a belonging that no one around us could ever earn, that we give as a free gift. It's an expression of an embodiment of God's heart. And the ministry that we have to the world, it's a ministry of saying there is a home. You don't need to wander homeless. You don't need to wonder whether there is a place where you are fully known and fully loved. There is a place in the heart of God which is embodied among us where that can actually, even if not yet in a full way, be tasted and experienced and seen because of an unexplained communion that is an overflow of the heart of God. Is that our understanding of what it means to belong to God and of what it means to belong to each other? This amazing prayer is the intercession of Jesus on our behalf. And it's an intercession that is asking for God to not only give us what Jesus' ministry has already shown is meant to be ours, but to pray it into reality that we might live it and trust it. And I want us to pray in that way now. Let's just take a moment to think about where we are in our own lives. Do we find ourselves, in that sense, homeless? Do we know truly that we belong in the heart of God who welcomes us, in our sinfulness, in our confusion, in our doubt, in our sense of failure and vulnerability? Oh God, seal to us that we belong to you. Seal for the first time today or for the thousandth time, the assurance that our lives are hidden in Christ, that we belong to you. And that if we belong to you, we belong also to one another. Across all kinds of different diversity lines, into a communion that is meant to enact here and now a love that is truly and distinctly yours. Help us, O God, to live into that kind of communion, to not settle for something less just because it's hard, just because it involves change, just because it means letting go of other places we belong, facing other fears, acknowledging things that are difficult, places where we have hurt one another, places where we fail each other. Lord, what we need is to know that we belong, to know that it is your glory in our midst, the very reality of your life that is our only hope, and that in fact is our ministry to Berkeley and to the world. Lord, enable us to live this love. For if it is this love that we live, it will focus our hearts and the hearts and minds of others to you. For we pray it in Jesus' great name.